Welcome, everyone, to the weekly Service Space Awaken call. We're going to get started in just a minute here, but before we begin, we'd like to just kick things off with a minute of silence to get ourselves grounded and prepared to listen to one another and our guests. So we'll just start things off with a minute of silence. Thank you. And again, good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you, depending on where you're calling in from the world, and welcome to the Awaken calls of the Service Space ecosystem. The purpose of these calls is to really create opportunities for our inner shifts by listening and learning from a worldwide community of changemakers, and particularly our guest speakers who have made courageous contributions to their own personal journeys and work. This week's guest is someone whose work I've been following and admiring for years, Sarah Van Gelder, who is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Yes Magazine, which has been really at the forefront of a lot of positive and solutions-driven activism. So we're gonna transition over to Yumi to introduce Sarah Van Gelder and begin the conversation with her. Yumi, it's all yours.
Thank you, Rahul, and thank you to everyone who shared, Aaron, Devin, Pancho, and Prakash. It's my pleasure to introduce Sarah. As co-founder and editor-in-chief of Yes Magazine, Sarah has been in the forefront of positive and solutions-driven activism. With articles like 10 Hopeful Things That Happened in 2013 and The Cooperative Way to a Stronger Economy, Sarah speaks on leading-edge innovations that show that another world is not only possible, it is being created. In handling wide-ranging topics from the new economy to alternatives to prisons to food systems to education, her work fuses powerful ideas with practical solutions. Along the way, she has interviewed people like Pete Seeger, Winona LaDuke, Vandana Shiva, and many other luminaries, as well as many unknown leaders who are working to create a better world. As part of her community involvement, Sarah co-founded Squamish Olala Neighbors, which builds bridges between Native and non-Native residents in the Port Madison Reservation. She co-led a statewide effort to return the home of Chief Seattle to the Squamish tribe and is a member of the board of directors of the tribally chartered Squamish Foundation. Sarah has traveled in Latin America, India, China, and Central America. She was a founding board member of Winslow Co-Housing and was previously a television and radio producer, a community organizer, founder of a food co-op that linked organic farmers to urban markets. So welcome to the call, Sarah. And there's a lot in your biography that we'd love to touch on. But first, I'd like to ask you foundation question. What led you to co-founding Yes Magazine?
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, Yumi, and I also want to say, I think this is the first time I've ever said good morning, good afternoon, and good evening in one breath to people, and that's kind of exciting to say that. And I also want to thank the people who shared just now. I love those stories, and that really helps to ground me in this conversation that we're having. Well, the journey that I took to founding Yes is sort of a life journey. It started, I won't give you my entire bio just now because I think that'll be be too tedious, but it started back when I was a child, and my family and I lived in India for a year. My father was on a Fulbright exchange, so he was teaching at a university in Andhra Pradesh. And so we lived on the university campus and went to school with children from the local community. And the experience was transformative for a number of reasons, and this is through the perspective of an eight-year-old. One was that I had this immersion in just an amazingly rich, beautiful culture that I just transformed me. I mean, my sisters and I took up classical Indian dance. One of my sisters also is a musician and took up learning the music, and we visited these beautiful temples. And so on the one hand, there's just this sense of, there being this whole other world that as an eight-year-old I hadn't ever encountered before that was so beautiful and so ancient. And then on the other hand, this sense that there are these children my own age who are suffering. You know, every time we'd go out on the street, there'd be hungry children there, and the level of suffering, I couldn't grasp why that should be and why it was that I was privileged enough to know that I would be taken care of every day, that I'd have enough to eat. So that question became sort of a lifelong question for me, is what creates that kind of poverty and suffering, and what can I do about it, as someone, again, who has the privilege to know that I can have enough every day. What can I do about that? So as that bio that Yumi read describes, I looked for answers to those questions in many different places. And I keep coming back to the notion that our whole society is in a period of transformation, that the injustices that create that level of suffering and poverty are unnecessary, that we can create a different kind of a world, and that all over the world there are people creating a better world. And so Yes Magazine is really about telling their stories, because they don't tend to show up in the press very much. The people who are doing the horrible things show up all the time, the people who are killing or the moments. I shouldn't say they are people who, because they're all obviously people who have many different facets to them, but the actions that people take that are violent and destructive get reinforced and amplified in the media all the time. And the actions that people are taking to build a better world in their communities, in their homes, and the people who are the tireless activists, those people's stories don't get told very much. And it seemed to me that it's really important to tell those stories and to show how they weave together. If we want to have a better world, we need to understand what other people are doing. We need to feel like we're not alone, that we're not crazy for having those values and those aspirations. And we need to understand something about how they all weave together into a different kind of a world. I believe that we are up against, as a civilization, as a people, we are up against huge challenges, particularly the climate crisis, but also the inequality crisis, and also the disintegration of democracy with so much power going to the 1% and large corporations. So I believe we're up against some huge challenges. And to me, if we can turn to each other and work together, there's almost nothing we can't do to take those on. But if we fail to do that, we probably can't do anything.
Thank you, Sarah. So you've talked a lot about the people that you want to highlight. I have a two-pronged question for you. One is, who are the people that have inspired you in your personal journey? And the second would be, who are the people that you've written about today that you feel we need to learn about and who are making a change?
Could you repeat the second part of that question?
The people who you feel today are making a change to create a better world, the people that you may have written about.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is people in your own personal life who have influenced you, and the second is the people that you have come across in your work who we should know about?
Well, I'd say in my personal life, of course, my parents have been huge influences on me. My parents were Quakers, and so they brought me up to believe that there is that of the divine in each person, and I extend that to all life in my own views of the world. And so there's this sense of the deep respect that each human being is entitled to. And so that has been something that has been a real core value for me right from the beginning. And that's sort of a foundation for a commitment to nonviolence as well, which is you can't be violent to people who you respect. And there's so many people that I've encountered who have inspired me, but let me just mention one who lives just a few miles from me. His name is Ted George. He's a tribal elder. He's, I believe, a descendant of Chief Seattle. And and I don't know if you want me to get into the story later on about the work I've been doing here with the Suquamish tribe, but
Go ahead.
So he was the one who I first met when I moved to Suquamish, and I was trying to understand what was going on with all the hostility that I was seeing from the non-natives who live on the reservation directed at the tribe. So he was the one that first, helped me understand what was going on and gave me a lot of guidance about what we needed to do about that. And one of the things he said was, there's so many people who point out the flaws in our community where there's things going badly, things like, and he didn't list these, but it's clear once you spend some time here in many reservations around the country that there's huge problems with drug abuse and alcoholism and child abuse and violence and so forth. They said people are always pointing out the flaws or the problems here, but what we need to do is we need to celebrate the heroes, the people who are strengthening our community, because they don't get much attention. And we need some role models. And so that was just one of the things that knowing him taught me. And what we did about that was we started holding a regular potluck. It was just once a year, but every year we would choose people in the community who had particularly stood out in terms of what they've been doing. One year it was a young woman who was teaching the native language to other people, and another year it was some teachers at a local elementary school who turned a big drainage pond in the schoolyard into a into a marsh where they grew native cattails, and then they brought in elders to teach the children how to weave those cattails into baskets in the traditional way. So the people who have been in small ways been stepping out and showing that kind of leadership that is ultimately transformative. So every year we would hold a potluck that just celebrated them, and our biggest expenditure of money, it's not the only money we ever spent as a group, was to get them gifts, to make sure that when we celebrated them, it wasn't just words. There was also some tangible way in which we could gift them for the service they were doing for the community. So those are a couple of people that have inspired me personally. In terms of the people that we write about, I mean, it's hard to even know where to start. I will say Poncho is one of the people who inspires me and who I had the privilege of interviewing him and running that interview at YesMagazine.org. So there are just so many, but I guess I'll mention one other person who I'm thinking a lot about because I'm thinking about about an issue of Yes Magazine that may build on her work. But her name is Sanya Davis. She works in Oakland. She works on restorative justice with Oakland youth. And she wrote an article that's in our education issue about what happens when instead of taking in this case, the story centers on a 14-year-old who is acting out in class and acting very inappropriately. And instead of doing what would normally be the practice in many schools, which is to suspend him, the restorative justice people said, well, let's look a little bit deeper and find out what's going on with this young man. And it turns out that in his case, his mother had relapsed into drug addiction. She'd been on rehab, but she'd relapsed. And so this 14-year-old boy was taking care of his younger brother and sister himself, and then trying to show up to class every day exhausted and worried and stressed out and in many cases hungry. And so instead of suspending him, which is what they would normally do, the principal said, you know, actually this young man deserves a medal for what he's been able to accomplish. And they held a restorative justice circle, which I'm sure a lot of people on this call know about what those are, but they're basically a chance for everybody who is involved in a situation to speak their piece and to make amends for what was done. And during this circle, the young man had a chance to explain what was going on. For him, the teacher had a chance to say, you know, this, when you threatened me in school, I was getting ready to quit my job. I just couldn't take it anymore. And the mom had a chance to hear what effects her actions as someone going back to substance abuse were having on other people and made up a new commitment to rehabilitation. The young man said he would do some after-class tasks to make up for how he acted out, and the teacher didn't quit. So instead of having the vicious cycle of, well, we'll punish him, and then he'll be out on his own with even less support, you know, to trying to deal with the situation, instead of doing that, the community came together and said, you know, let's work this out together, because there is no one person who's the blame. This is actually a number of different factors that are all coming to bear here. So Sanya Davis is the one that wrote that article, and I found it so inspiring and so important in a time when our response to so many things is about punishing the bad person, you know, picking out the person who did wrong and punishing them, whether that's the police officer who pulled the trigger in Ferguson or if it's the young man in the school classroom. That often it's an important to hold people accountable, but there's so much more that we need to do to restore or to bring rightness. And Sanya Davis is really looking very carefully at those questions and is working with us on a subsequent follow-up piece that will look more broadly at the question of how we apply restorative justice to our whole society.
Wow, those are some amazing stories. I particularly love the story you told about holding regular potlucks and actually celebrating local heroes in the community. Now, it reminds me a little bit of sort of neighborhood block parties that people hold everywhere, but they don't have that additional element of actually highlighting positivity in the community, and people just get together and have a party. But I think that's such an important connector for people in a community. So thank you for sharing that story. And restorative justice is so powerful. Every time I hear a story of someone who's held those circles, it just is such a whole justice, a whole person justice, whole people justice, that it really does restore my faith in humanity. So I'd like to get to the touch on the topic of unity and diversity by asking you about the work that you've done with the Suquamish tribe. We brought up Ted George, who is one of the tribal elders. Can you tell us, in the introduction you mentioned that you had been a part of, an integral part of returning the home of Chief Seattle to the Squamish tribe. Can you tell us how your group overcame that deep-seated antagonism that others, the non-natives, felt about the natives, tribes and the community?
Well, first off, I think the tribe itself was mainly responsible for that, because they have been so 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 respectful and so just extraordinary as local leaders. So I just want to make sure that the credit goes where it's due. So the particular story of about the, let me just back up a little bit to how I first got involved. I moved to the reservation not because I had any ambitions about getting involved with the tribe in any meaningful way. I just found a house here that I could afford to buy, and there's a lot of non-natives living here, and so I just bought a house and moved in. And was sort of minding my own business. I was raising two children and editing Yes Magazine at the time, so I pretty much felt like I had my hands full. But one of my neighbors knocked on my door and said, the tribe's trying to build housing down the street from us, and we have to stop them. And so I realized then that I probably couldn't stay uninvolved. She told me about a meeting that was being held at the local church, and, you know, we were all going to stay unified against the tribe. That was the word, and we should all show up there to show our unity. So, of course, I had to go because otherwise I'd be assumed to be part of that unity. And once I was there, I had to speak. I ended up hearing for an hour and a half, just hearing one person after another talk about how we didn't want them as neighbors, and, you know, they wouldn't be good for our neighborhood. And, you know, it was just an eye-opener and really very disturbing to listen to. So after listening to that for an hour and a half, I finally got up and said, you know, of course they have the right to build up homes for their families and elders in the community. It is the reservation, and of course we can welcome them here, and just as they welcome the settlers who arrived here not that long ago. So having said that, I decided to leave the meeting early because I really didn't want to talk to people afterwards because I am a little bit of a coward. And so I walked out, and as I was walking out, somebody followed me to thank me, as it turned out, and that was Ted George. And because he saw that I was willing to step up in front of that kind of group, that sort of built the foundation of a trusting relationship that has lasted since then. That was over 10 years ago. So he introduced me to some of the elders, and that became really important because a few weeks later, Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated. Nobody knows who did it, but a lot of people believe it was related to the same antagonism about the housing project. So this time I felt like I had to do more than show up by myself. I felt like we needed to, you know, have a group of people respond. I was sort of waiting for the normal human rights leaders, and I sort of assumed, you know, there'd be somebody in the church or somebody would step up and say, you know, we've got to do something here. And when nobody did, I called together my friends. We called the church, a meeting at the church, not a religious meeting, just that was the only meeting space in town. And Ted George introduced me to some of the elders and tribal leaders, so some of them also came, and we formed this organization to respond to the antagonism. So that was sort of the background, and then we were kind of going along having these, you know, we did what the tribe asked us to do, which was to come to their the ceremony to reconsecrate the grave and to make a statement. And then I was kind of confused about what to do next, because I was also getting the signal from tribal members sort of informally that, you know, there's been a lot of white do-gooders coming in here who haven't done any good, and we just assumed you guys went away. And I thought, yeah, that's probably true. We probably should go away. We don't know what we're doing. And that was my initial inclination until Ted said, no, we've got more work to do. And since we don't know what that is right now, we'll at least do potlucks. So that's what we did for a while. And then a couple years later, one of the tribal leaders contacted me because the land that Chief Seattle's home was on, what used to be the largest longhouse in the region, and with what's now a state park, that land, the state was sort of making signals that they might be willing to turn it back over to the tribe. But every time that had come up before, the same local people who deposed the tribe on everything else had opposed this, and the state had backed off. So he said, you know, maybe if we work together, we can get it done this time. So, of course, you know, that seemed so important to do that. I mean, this place has this extraordinary history. This, as I mentioned, was the largest longhouse in the region. It was probably, estimates go from 600 to 900 feet long, and there were hundreds of people who lived there over a long period of time. and it was where Chief Seattle lived most of his life. And it was also the center of the Suquamish Nation. This particular piece of land is what their nation is named after, is the Squaquab, which means the place of the clear salt water. Mm-hmm. And after Chief Seattle had died, the military decided to burn it down so they could convince people to live as they believe people should live, which is in separate households, and they should, instead of being fisher people and gatherers, they should be farmers. So they burned down the longhouse, and suddenly the entire community was homeless. The community rebuilt the village on that same site, but they did it in separate houses, I guess believing that that would placate the military. And then a few years later, the military said, well, they need the entire waterfront of Suquamish to build fortifications for the Bremerton Shipyard, which is inland from here. So they basically took the tribe's entire waterfront land. So then people were scattered, and the village was dismantled, and the graveyard had to move. And the state of Washington had known enough to see the historic importance of this land. Oh, wait a minute, I'm jumping ahead. So then the military never built fortifications. They sold it to developers for a few years. So whether they ever intended to build fortifications, I don't know. But in any case, they sold it to developers. The developers divvied it up into plots of land to build summer cabins for people from Seattle to come over and enjoy the waterfront. So the state of Washington saw the historic importance of the land and bought three of those plots and made it into a state park. So it's a tiny little state park, but it still has enormous importance as the center of the tribe's village. So when I was asked to help work on that, of course, I said I would do that. And the organization Suquamish Olala Neighbors, which we had founded, also immediately got on board. So I won't give you the entire history of our efforts in conjunction with the tribe to convince the state to go ahead and give that land back against the opposition of my neighbors. I won't give you that entire history, but there's one moment that what some of the stories earlier made me think might be worth bringing up, which is that very early on, we made a commitment to doing a management plan for the park, so the neighbors would realize that this was going to be a place that they could continue to enjoy and wouldn't feel that, you know, that they were going to be excluded from it. And in creating that management plan, we started by holding a session in the tribe's gym, where we invited everybody who wanted to come and share their concerns about what they would like the park to be like. Because, you know, again, the tribe had committed to continuing to use it as a park. But normally these kinds of input processes involve, you know, a panel of people sitting at the front, and then one at a time people get up and speak. And we decided we weren't going to do that, in part because we knew that from having been to many of these occasions, that would be an invitation to some of the most divisive and most, frankly, racist people to get up and to speak, and it would be further injure the relationship. So instead of doing that, we had a bunch of small groups scattered, a table scattered around the gym on different topics like security and maintenance and recreational uses. And so we invited people to come and sit in small groups with members of the tribe and with the neighbors and just talk about what they cared about, and write their concerns on sticky papers and put them up on the wall. And then every so often we ring a bell and people can move to a different table. So the result was that everybody really got heard. You know, every concern was noted. Everybody, the conversations were in small groups instead of in those big fraught settings. And there was that kind of informal exchange which had not been happening very much up until then. And all those comments ended up going into a database. The database became the management plan, and the management plan then went back out to everybody who wanted to comment on. So that, you know, when several people in the first part of this morning's session talked about listening, I was thinking about that moment because I think it was one of the steps that helped to begin the healing is that there was that kind of deep listening. Now, at the same time, the opposition continued. That same group of people, you know, the same number, they never were able to increase their numbers very much because, frankly, they couldn't win sympathy, even though they brought in a right-wing radio talk show jock and, you know, all those kinds of things. They were just not able to increase their support very much. But they knew that they'd been heard, and after we were finally successful in getting a unanimous decision to return the land to the tribe, there wasn't a big backlash. There wasn't, you know, the same kind of vitriol that we used to hear.
No, thank you for sharing that. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I love that the small group topics, small groups gathered around different topics, which gives everyone a chance to be heard, and also doesn't allow for grandstanding that you were afraid of. We have maybe a couple of minutes left in this part of the call, and I know that you've got a new book coming out in November called Sustainable Happiness, which includes a piece written by one of our service-based coordinators, Pavi Mehta. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you thought it was important to have it published now?
Sure. And if we could, I'd also like to, if we have time, I'd also love to tell you about the upcoming issue of Yes, because I think some of your listeners may have some good ideas for me on that.
Sure.
So on the book, it's called Sustainable Happiness, and the subtitle is Live Simply, Live Well, Make a Difference. And the idea is that there's a lot of self-help books out there that are sort of about, how do I get a happier life for myself? And we believe that's important, but we also think that to get real about happiness is to get real about our well-being as a community, as a society, and the well-being of planet Earth. Because those things are all really intertwined. So if we want to look at one, we need to look at the others. And so the book is an anthology of articles that we've published over the years about happiness, about how happiness is far more related not to, you know, again, in our consumer culture, a lot of messages come out every day that, you know, that you'll be happy if you own this car or this, you know, flat screen TV or this new tech gadget. And our view is that happiness is much more, and the scientific research backs it up, happiness is much more related to having meaningful work or meaningful ways of making a contribution, the quality of your relationships, choosing to approach life with a sense of gratitude instead of a sense of scarcity, those kinds of things. So those turn out to be related, because if part of what you want to do is to make a contribution, that's going to benefit your community, and that kind of well-being will actually come back and make you happier and make the whole community happier. And one of the things that's so striking to me about this is how much wealth there is in our communities when we turn it loose by allowing people to find each other and connect to each other and to appreciate one another and to experience that appreciation. So we look at this at all these different levels. What does it mean for us as individuals in terms of how to be happier? What does it mean in terms of our relationships to our community? What are some of the habits that bring about happiness, and how do we measure it? How can we look at, for example, gross national happiness instead of the gross national product?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. We look forward to reading it. And you said you wanted to mention the latest issue of Yes Magazine?
Well, this is actually the upcoming issue, and the reason that I'm particularly eager to talk about it is because I'm just in the beginning of formulating it now, and I think maybe some of your listeners may have some good ideas for us. So this won't come out until summer of next year, but I'm beginning the research now. And the idea is to look at the question of how do we make it right? How do we make old wrongs and new wrongs right? This is partly inspired by how much violence we've seen this summer, in ranging from in Ferguson to the kinds of just extreme situations that are going on in the Middle East and in Africa, where people, you know, and some of those cases, like the war in Syria, there's good reason to believe that climate change has actually caused the displacement of enough people that set off these conflicts that then erupted into war. So there's this question of, you know, with climate change creating more and more stresses, are we going to see the ethnic and racial divides acting as kind of like a fault line where maybe people have gotten along, but then the pressure increases and those become the places where the earthquakes take place. How do we look at the historic traumas that kind of keep us divided? I think the United States has some huge historic trauma that we have, as a society, refused to look at, particularly the founding traumas of slavery and of Native American genocide. And having refused to look at those, we allow a lot of the dissonance to continue to fester. So how can we take a restorative justice approach to that, you know, and say that if we want healing, we have to start with an acknowledgement of what was done wrong, and we have to start with some form of reparation or restitution, and then we can start a really meaningful healing process. So what does that look like in practice? So those are the kinds of questions, you know, we look at truth and reconciliation, whether that's part of the answer, how restorative justice might be helpful. So those are the kinds of questions I'm going to be looking at, and would love to have input from your listeners about stories specifically, especially very specific stories, because those are the ones that really move people, that make them believe that restorative justice isn't just an idea for, you know, bleeding heart liberals. It's actually a very practical way of getting things done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. I think we're probably at the end of this part of the call, but I would invite, I don't know if Rahul would agree, invite callers to actually comment on what you've just raised in terms of how do we go about writing the past wrong.
Absolutely. Thank you, Yumi. And Sarah, you shared how your experience of poverty as a child living in Andhra Pradesh really shaped a lot of the way that you started looking at the world, and that much of your work since then has been a sort of search for finding an answer to that. But what I'm curious about is how your processing of the answer to the question of sort of what causes that level of poverty in the world has changed over time, from that first experience as a child through the sort of various stages of its evolution and arriving at the present day. Like, what were the sort of stepping stones, signposts that you sort of walked through as you processed that question for yourself?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's a lot of decades of time between then and now. So, one of the other formative experiences for me was discovering that my country was at war in Vietnam, and just being appalled at the violence that I saw my country perpetrating on another people. And so, in both cases, it felt like you know, that I had a responsibility to step up, because things were, you know, in the case of Vietnam especially, things were being done in my name that I just found to be wrong. So I guess the first thing would be that sense of responsibility that you don't get to just pretend it's not happening. You know, you have, it just would be irresponsible to not, you know, take some kind of a stand and take some kind of action. So then the second one is, well, what's effective? What really makes a difference. So for a while, I was very interested in the question of international aid. You know, maybe the way to go is to share the wealth in this country by sending money and doing having various kinds of charity efforts. And I spent some time in Guatemala with my sister, who is working for an international charity NGO, and I wound up feeling like there is too much that goes wrong in those efforts. Too much of it is top down, that it is a paternalistic approach to it that actually undermines in often the local initiatives. I remember going with her to visit a village where the NGO was going to put in a health clinic, and the people there had already spent months figuring out how to find the land, and then they had built the foundations, and were working on building this building, and the NGO came in and said, you know, that's just not right for the modular health clinic we have in mind, so that's got to go. And it felt like it was undermining of their own efforts. And at that time, this was in Guatemala when the war was going on against the indigenous people, I'd met people who were working on starting local cooperatives, but the government, you know, was assassinating anybody who stepped out of line in any way, even so much as starting a cooperative among indigenous people. So people were dying, you know, by the thousands, and I knew that my government was helping to support that. Mm-hmm. So the whole charity model just seemed really problematic to me. And so if it's not going to be charity, then, then the question is, well, what are the underlying dynamics that create poverty? And so many of them have to do with our international economic system that systematically moves wealth and power and resources to the center, to the countries that are already wealthy and powerful. So that was where I came out after college, was just feeling like that entire system is systematically creating poverty, and I want to create a different kind of system. So, you know, what does that look like? And in the end, you know, after some both intellectual experimentation, but even more just on-the-ground experimentation with, you know, that cooperative that I helped to start, I came to believe that the way to make a change is to change it on the ground, to change the conditions that we create in terms of our own economy, and say, you know, this is a different way. It's more satisfying. It's more ecologically sustainable. It's more fair. It has room for everyone. It isn't all about turning resources and people into commodities. It's the opposite, that people are the point, and the natural world, protecting the natural world is the point, not the means to an end of creating wealth for somebody.
Well, thank you. I know that we do have a few questions in the queue, and I believe the first one is from Pancho. So I'm going to open that up. Pancho?
It is so great to hear and feel your voice, Hermana Sara. I'm just going to repeat a little bit, you know, for me, Yes Magazine is the oxygen of the revolution, because not only points out the problems that we are facing right now, but also shows the solutions, and not only the solutions, but people living the solutions, and sometimes people embody the solutions. And for me, one of the ways that you, beloved sister, embody this revolution is by this unity and diversity. You've seen so many people, you connect with so many love warriors and love magicians from all over the planet. It is super inspiring. And I think that what going into the wave of the meme of that you were creating right now in your sharing, I'm wondering, what did you learn, or how were you transformed by the Zapatistas and Gustavo Esteva? You know, the Zapatistas who started the planetary movement for social justice, and all the things that you were saying, how we started with a thing called NAFTA, right? This this treaty that is just creating that, and they just said no since 1994. So I know that you have some experience with there, and you were the one also that brought to my attention to Gustavo. So I'm very curious about, you know, if you have any nuggets there about what did you learn from them, from the Zapatistas and Gustavo, or how did they transform your life? I'm curious about that.
Oh, thank you for that, Pancho. Yeah, I had the honor of spending about a week with Gustavo in the spring and some time in San Cristobal de Las Casas and Chiapas as well. There's a history of people who have been opposing colonialism and global capitalism, corporate capitalism. I want to distinguish that kind of capitalism from the marketplace, because I'm not anti-market. I'm anti the dominance of huge corporations and the way in which they have affected communities all over the world. So there's a history of that opposition that's been, sort of about the violent liberation struggles that ended colonialism, but also instituted governments that were built on violence. And the Zapatista model seems to me like a really important other way. It, as Pancho said, it was formed in opposition to NAFTA, the big trade agreement, which also in Mexico meant the end of the ejido system, so the communal land ownership that had sustained communities throughout the country was dismantled as part of instituting NAFTA. When I was there just this spring, I was seeing the continuation of that process because communities all over Mexico are, and particularly in the South, are grappling with the attempts by large corporations to extract the land to use oftentimes for mining or to get the water or in some cases for agribusiness. And that means that the foundation of all of those communities is threatened. You know, without the land, these communities, rural communities, have no livelihood and no way to continue. So the Zapatistas has been one of the main resistance movements to that. And among the many things that are fascinating about it, and we could have the whole session just on that, but this brings in these extraordinary indigenous ways of thinking about the world and of living. It's not a European worldview imposed on a traditional community. It is really intrinsically a indigenous process. And so I think the rest of the world, certainly a lot of the other social movements, have been learning from the Zapatistas. And I think around the world, someone mentioned the climate march. I think maybe two Pancho mentioned the climate march and how it was led by indigenous people. I think that's one of the most important trends right now, is that the indigenous people themselves and the worldview of being indigenous, of being rooted in place and respecting Mother Earth and respecting the importance of community, the kinds of worldview that you see in indigenous people all over the world, that's becoming increasingly important. So there's lots more I could say about that, but I don't know how much of the time we
want
to devote to that.
Yeah, well, ultimately, we all are indigenous people of the planet, right? Indigenous people of the earth, if we want to look at that way. So thank you, sister.
Thanks, Pancho, for that question. We're going to move on to the next question in the queue. I believe it's Devin.
Hi, yes, thanks, Rahul. Hi, Sarah. I am enjoying listening to your conversation, and so insightful. One thing that intrigued me was when you mentioned, Sarah, that the way the economic system is set up right now, the people that have a lot to begin with are getting more, and so how do you get around that, or how do you solve that problem? And if you would give us pointers as to where and how, for example, I can learn more about, like, for example, what can I do and where should I focus if I want to do a little something that would help going to the crux of the issue here?
Oh, that's so big. I mean,
I'm just thinking, like, if there is a way for me to learn a few things, or if I want to, for example, spend a little of time doing something, where would that be, and how do I find out about that?
Yeah. Well, to me, the question of inequality, you know, the growing divide between the the rich and the poor, is driven by our economic system. So in a sense, we really need to make the transition to an economy that is where wealth and power is much more distributed, where, you know, there's many more opportunities for people to be either part of owning the economy, part owners, as in a worker co-op, for example, or where we are protecting the commons so that everyone has access to it. So the essential things that it takes to live are, you know, that everyone has access to those essentials. So that's one way to look at it, is can we build a new economy? And next week is New Economy Week. And if you look at the yesmagazine.org website, we'll have a lot of coverage of it, and certainly other people will as well. But next week is New Economy Week, so a lot of people are looking at what does that new economy look like, and telling those stories and asking questions of themselves and their friends about how to take that to the next step. So that would be one approach. The second one is more political, which is the question of how money has come to dominate politics so much that then the rules that govern our society through government are biased towards the folks that are already rich, because they're the ones that are in many cases affecting the elections. And, you know, this is something that both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party has affected both parties tremendously. So that in some senses, the billionaires are calling the shots on what's even allowed into the dialogue. And so it's not just a question of saying, well, let's go out and support Democrats, although I'll have to tell you that the idea that the Republicans would control the Senate, I find terrifying. But it's a deeper question than that. How do we actually change what's on the agenda of our political discussion so that it's the agenda of ordinary people? And for me, that means building local, independent political movements that set their own agenda and then call political leaders to account for whether or not they have met the agenda that we the people set. So those are a couple ways
Thank you.
That I can see. Getting and Yes Magazine has a tremendous amount on. If you look at our website, we have a tab called New Economy, and there's an awful lot of material in there. We cover it every week in some respect. We do some amount of critique on what we think is wrong with the economy as it stands, but our main focus is on what kind of an economy are people building that would be both more fair and more ecologically sustainable.
I'll definitely read up more on your website. So thank you for the answer, Sarah.
You're very welcome.
We'll move on to the next question, which I believe is from Prakash.
Yes, Rahul, thank you. Yumi and Sarah, I'm feeling very thankful to you for gifting us this insightful conversation. Sarah, first is a quick comment and follow it up with a question about the book, the upcoming book. I really loved the title and also the subtitle. And happy to know that our dear friend Pavi also has a contribution to it. Looking forward to it. The title, Sustainable Happiness, How to Live Simply, Live Well, and Make a Difference. That's beautiful. So my question is around, I think the way I look at it is perhaps an intersection answer to this probably is perhaps find some hints towards how do we right the wrong. Probably a question would emerge from it. The question is, right now, if you look at the overall at a systemic level, when we talk about the economy in not just the developing world, also in the developed world, I see a pretty lopsided view of improving the economy. Yes, there are some glimpses of effort being done to balance that development in the economy with taking the ecological aspects also into consideration. So I think, in my opinion, when we talk about the violence, I think one of the greatest violence that we as the humanity is contributing or being the center of it is the violence that is happening to the planet Earth. So I think, what do you think from your, you know, some interacting with the different groups and the policymakers, and also at the individual level, where do you see a ray of hope in terms of, or also some insights for all of us to learn and practice in our daily lives? Some of the ideas and practices, both at the individual and at the systemic level, how we can bring about this dialogue of growing economy balanced with ecological aspects as well.
Yeah, very good question. It's a really big one. I think the climate crisis is kind of changing everything, as Naomi Klein says, and I highly recommend her book, This Changes Everything. It's just a fabulous book, and I just had a chance to interview her about it. So, and she spent 10 years, I think, researching it, and it's 400 pages of answers to that very question. So I think this climate crisis is an existential crisis. It's a question of, in the coming decades, will we even have a civilization? And some people are even taking it as far as asking if we'll have a human species, you know, if we'll actually cause human extinction. Mm. So I think we have to take that very, very seriously. I mean, even if it's only a 10% chance of human extinction, is that okay to allow that to continue that way, you know? We have to take that very seriously, and that means a level of shift in how we do things that is not politically feasible right now, because politicians, are too answerable right now to the big oil and gas and coal companies who very much want to make the money that they feel that they're entitled to make by extracting all that oil and coal and gas and burning it up. And the political leaders have not been willing to take a stand against that. So when we see that kind of situation happen, that means, as important as the election is, and again, I don't want to downplay the importance of the midterm election, but ultimately we're going to have to take matters into our own hands. In the part of the country that I'm in, that means people are blockading trains, coal trains, and they're working with the native people who are trying to keep the big oil, new oil pipelines coming in. The one going into Vancouver, British Columbia, would actually take 1 million barrels of tar sands oil every day and bring it out to the port and then transport it across the ocean in these huge tankers. This tiny little impoverished tribe in north of Vancouver is one of the only things standing in the way. I mean, so we have to be ready to kind of blockade this stuff. It's some people call these places blockadias, the places where we're just saying, no, we will not expand the extraction and transportation of fossil fuels. In fact, we have to shrink it. So part of it is becoming an activist, and that doesn't necessarily suit all of us. Some of us just don't want to be, sitting in front of train tracks, and yet I think that's part of what we're called to do. And part of it is whatever work we're doing now, connecting it to to this climate crisis, because we're, you know, whether we're working for a new economy, you know, the new economy has got to be one that works for the climate, and it, whether we're working for racial justice, the racial, you know, the people of color are the ones that are going to be impacted in many cases the most severely by the climate crisis. So whatever we're doing, I think we need to connect it to that crisis. In terms of what people do as individuals, I feel that, you know, that whatever we do has to come from our heart, and it the two things that seem to apply pretty universally, it has to come from our heart, and very few people can do it alone. You know, most people need to be working with other people. So, you know, my usual advice is to either start with the people you're already working with, or if you don't have people you're already working with, to find, even if it's just two or three or four other people who share the same thing that's calling you, and spend time together thinking and talking about, you know, what do you do, how do you take the next step, and how do you make a difference. And I actually do believe that very small groups of people who have that level of passion and concern and tenacity, it doesn't happen overnight, but tenacity, really do make things change. And eventually the political leaders will follow us. Maybe not right away, but eventually they will.
I hear you. Yeah.
Sarah, this is Rob. I'm wondering if you feel there are any examples of businesses working in the modern context who are actually making a positive difference on this trajectory of climate change, and whether you could comment on some of the more public examples. You know, and what comes to mind for me is, you know, I have this sort of admiration and also a little bit of an interesting reaction to the things that Elon Musk does, particularly around the combination between Tesla Solar City and SpaceX, right? This idea of getting transportation more sustainable and then generating massive distributed energy across the country, but then also having a sort of escape hatch for planet Earth if we screw this place up, right, through being able to, for instance, get to Mars. And Elon Musk has said that, you know, it's one of he would like to die on Mars. But anyways, I'm just curious about what examples from the modern business context jump out to you as folks who are really making a very strong positive change in this rather daunting trajectory that we're on with climate change.
Well, I was just on the Mars thing, I don't think there is an escape hatch. It may be in a few hundred years we would have a capacity to actually live somewhere else, but right now we still, I don't see, unless you're talking about an extremely small number of people and everybody, you know, the billions here on Earth just expiring, I don't think there's any meaningful escape hatch. So I think we have to devote our efforts to keeping alive a living planet, which is the only one we know of right now. This planet is alive itself, and it being alive is what makes it possible for us to be alive. So we need to keep that alive. In terms of the businesses that are doing great work, I mean, there's, you know, what I would point to are the ones that have sustainability built in at their core, not the ones that are sort of, you know, some of them are even greenwashing, that are, you know, doing some things around the edges, even though their core business activity is destructive. For example, some of the oil companies who might have a green corporate headquarters or something. So some of the ones I'll tell you one that I really like is in Chicago. It's called New Era Windows and Doors, and it's a company that was going to shut down and laid off all its workers, and they ended up occupying the factory, and in the end ended up buying it out. It's kind of a long story, but they ended up buying it out and forming a worker cooperative, and they build super efficient windows and doors. And an awful lot of what we need to do to solve our climate crisis is to quit wasting so much energy. So mundane things like efficiency are just incredibly important.
Thank you. And then the sort of last question that I guess is my privilege to ask you as a host of the calls is what you feel we can do as a community to support the work that you're involved with and to support your work directly. How can we be of service to you?
Oh, that's such a lovely question. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for having me on this call. I just so enjoyed hearing from everyone and the provocative questions. So there's several ways. I mean, YES is a nonprofit, and we are able to do the work we do because we have thousands of people who in some way contribute, whether they get a subscription to the magazine or get gift subscriptions, or we have a couple thousand who give us a little donation every month, and that those little donations add up and are just, you know, a really important basis of our support. We call them dedicated friends. So, you know, certainly financial help and spreading the word about YES and sharing our stories with your friends and all of those things. They're just, you know, we kind of operate in the gift economy that we give away all of our material online, even if it's been in the magazine. It ends up on the website for free, and we also put it in the Creative Commons so that anyone can pick it up and distribute it, because that's what we're all about. And we don't take advertising. And so it's been that kind of support that people who see that and appreciate it that's kept us going. And then the other thing is, you know, to write your comments on the articles, you know, this particular issue that we're doing on Making It Right, to send your ideas about, you know, what are the stories there, the specific stories where you've seen that kind of transformation happening. So contributing your ideas, that's also really helpful. And
wonderful.
Our website again is yesmagazine.org, and how to reach us and to get involved or to buy the book. We actually have a book club price for the book, so we sell it as cheaply as we can so that people can share it with their friends or use it for book clubs.
Wonderful. And again, the title of that book is Sustainable Happiness. And the subtitle, could you tell us the subtitle once again, Sarah?
Sure. It's Sustainable Happiness. Live simply, live well, make a difference.
Beautiful. And it seems like the tagline itself is a summary of your life and work as well. So I just wanted to thank you so much for being on the call. What we like to do to end the call is, in the similar vein in which we started, to end with a moment of silence. But this time the moment of silence is in gratitude for all of the conditions that have allowed us to come together and to listen and learn from one another. So we'll just have a minute of silence, after which I'm going to unmute everyone on the call so we can publicly express our thanks to Sarah for taking time out of her Saturday morning to join us. So we'll just have a minute of silence in gratitude. Thank you all so much. We've now all been unmuted, so and we will be sending out links to YES Magazine and to Sarah's work after the call. But for now, we're all unmuted, and we have an opportunity to just express our thanks to Sarah for joining us on this morning's Awaken call. So on the count of three, we will all say thank you, Sarah. Ready? One, two, three. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being on the call, and look forward to joining you again next week on the next Awaken call. Have a great weekend, folks.
Thank you so much.